welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for stopping by today. It is a pleasure to speak with you once again. As always, if you are a newcomer, the website is redicecreations.com, where we have a lot more radio programs for you on many of the topics that you never knew you needed to know about. All the things that are important, at least if you ask me, regarding our past and also our future, if you are interested in us having one, that is. But since you're here, I believe you do. Well, today we have Stephen McNallan back on the program for a very exciting development, a next step, not only for one of our oldest European faiths, but also, I think, something that is a big part in reawakening European traditional roots and anchoring that in our world in a way we haven't seen before, and something that is very important, and we want you to be part of it as well. If you missed some of our previous shows with Stephen, let me just tell you a little bit about him. He's been a soldier, a journalist, a juvenile corrections officer, and a school teacher. In 1971, he founded the Viking Brotherhood, the first legally recognized religious organization dedicated to the gods and goddesses of Northern Europe. Today, McNallan is the head of the Ásatrú Folk Assembly, the preeminent Ásatrú organization on the North American continent. Welcome back, Stephen. It's great to have you with us again. Hope you've been doing well since we last spoke.
Well, we've been doing very well indeed. Of course, it's what we're going to talk about tonight. Everything's going really well, and I hope everything is great over your direction.
Absolutely. It's good to speak with you, and it's a really exciting time right now as well. We have a lot of things to discuss today. Of course, you do have some exciting news to share with us. Basically, a new development that I personally hope and think will actually kick off something around all of our ancient heathen European nations that either have a direct tie to, either if it's Ásatrú or to an older faith, something that is related in one way or another. Tell us about the new plans and how you got to this point, Stephen.
Well, for decades, we have wanted a place of our own to conduct our rites, our rituals, to where we could gather for all sorts of religious functions, to serve as sort of an Ásatrú community center and so forth, you know, just a multi-purpose sort of place. And we've never had that. We've always had to rent places, and that's all very nice because there's some great places to rent, and you can get the meals catered and all of that, but it's, you know, that runs into thousands and thousands of dollars. And a lot of the times we just like to gather out in nature, and that's fine too. There's a lot of precedent for that. But we've always wanted a building, a hof, a place that we could dedicate strictly to our religion, to our practice, and to our spiritual needs. And finally, after all these years, we're going to get one.
Why now? Why not earlier, do you think?
Well, there were a number of false starts, and all too often, there are personalities that get in the way, or a particular person will say, well, I'll fund it, or, you know, here, we can put it on this land, and we'll give this land to the AFA. And, of course, that never quite happens, or, you know, there's personalities and politics and disagreements, and people have falling outs. It's just human nature. But finally, what we've got is something that is not on anyone else's property. We are beholden to no one for it, although we are out there, you know, raising funds in the public on Indiegogo. But it's ours, and or it will be ours in a few weeks, and we're feeling really optimistic about that and really good about that. But this timing is a strange thing, and again, this is something you might want to come back to in a little bit, but it seems as though once an idea catches on somewhere, it transmits itself invisibly to other people. Call it synchronicity, or the wind blowing through the branches of the world tree, or what have you. Other people get the same idea at about the same time. And we're seeing that effect, but we're just glad that it's our turn, and we're actually a little bit ahead of the curve of the other people who are doing stuff like this right now.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe it's the 100th monkey or something like that. You know, the phenomena, you know, that catches on when 100 monkeys do it, then all the other ones know how to do it. I don't know. But the Icelanders are of course building one as well, and we just spoke briefly about it here before we began. But it's interesting because I think it's a sign of something. It looks like their particular angle might be a little bit more a little bit more official, tied to the state or whatever. It might be a little looks very modern, the building that I've seen so far. I'm not saying it's a good idea or anything like that at all, but it feels it might be a little bit of a different direction than what you guys are doing. Do you think that's correct?
I think it's a very different direction. I mean, what they do is their business, you know, it's no concern of ours, really. And there's some parts of me that say, yeah, it'd be nice to have something that was a little bit more contemporary, a little more modern. But deep down inside, in my heart of hearts, I'm kind of a traditionalist. And I like to do it the way it was done, you know, 1,000 years ago. I'm not that way in everything. But when it comes to important things like the design of ritual buildings, I think that those are so deeply embedded in our unconscious that they're virtually archetypal, and that we mess with that at risk.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think also one of the reasons why this is becoming you know, kind of topical is that we have a millennial anniversary coming up here, and it's a little bit difficult to know exactly. There's different dates and numbers going around, but anywhere from, I don't know, 1,050 to 1,080 or 90. It's speculated that one of the last kind of node points, the most central point of one of these temple sites in Scandinavia, in Uppsala, where this temple was burnt. And so we're coming up to that 1,000 years anniversary here soon. And so I think it's something in a timely, interesting kind of way that is awakening again, and people are longing back for something. And I think it's tremendously, you know, it's synchronicity that we find ourselves in 1,000 years after right now, don't you think?
I do think that synchronicity plays a large role in things like this. And 1,000 years is kind of an interesting time span for to have, you know, to complete the circuit, so to speak. I reflect back to the early 1970s. When I founded the Viking Brotherhood that later became the Asatru Free Assembly. And at the same time, unknown to me, people in England had the Committee for the Restoration of the Odinic Rite that later became the Odinic Rite. And up in Canada, Elsa Christensen was publishing The Odinist. And the Icelanders also were starting to move in those directions. I suppose some of them had been doing it for a while, but as far as an official organization or anything goes, all of our things came together within a period of a few months, even though none of us were in correspondence with each other at that time. We didn't even know the other person existed. You know, this was before the internet. So it's one of those synchronistic things. When it's time, it's time.
Yep, you're right. Now, let's talk a little bit more about the building here, and maybe later we can talk about some of the stories that come to us through the writings and the sagas about the old temple and how that looked and whatnot. And I think we do have some pretty good imagery from some of the remnants of the stave churches in Norway. I just have a feeling when I look at those that is something which is how they used to look, probably more on a grand scale, though. They even mentioned something interesting about a gold chain that apparently decorated the whole temple around. I don't know if you guys are going to be doing that, but how much do you want it to look like an old temple, Stephen?
In the short term, I don't think that's very important. I think as time goes by, we would make adaptations to it to give it a more of that thematic look. If anybody goes onto our Indiegogo campaign site or goes into the Newgrange Asatru Hof Facebook page, they'll see photographs of what the building looks like right now. And it's a wooden rectangular structure. And from the front especially, it would be very easy to imagine some carved varge boards, like with crossed horse heads or dragon heads or whatever on it, that would just make it a lot like those old stave churches and so forth. So I think over time we'll probably adapt and kind of do a little bit of retro stuff and kind of see where that takes us. But there's time for that.
Yeah, exactly. It reminds me a little bit of actually Lord of the Rings, and of course Tolkien read a lot of old Norse mythology, but the I don't know if you remember the movies or how he describes it in the book, but the Rohan, they have this temple up on a hill, basically. It's not really a mountain, but it's like a kind of something rising right out of the landscape. And up on this hill, they have this beautiful temple with, of course, a lot of horse head decorations and whatnot on it. And it just, it's such a beautiful thing what they created there, and I have a feeling that something like that would just look, you know, wonderful and whatnot. But what, tell us about the building that's there now then. How, that was built in 1938, I think, and I mean, it looks like kind of a little bit like a longhouse, to be honest.
Well, it does a bit. It's a large rectangular building made out of wood. It was built in 1938 as the local Grange Hall in this small community. And this small community is up in the foothills of Northern California in a little town called Brownsville. And it's got fine trees all around it. And it's a very rural setting. And the people are country people, which is the sort of people who like to get involved in the things that we do anyway. You know, people who are not urbanized and plugged into 21st century popular culture and so forth. And it's an ideal site. And there's a couple of things that really, really made us think that we were, I would use the word supposed to have this. Some interesting synchronicities. And if you've got a moment, I'll kind of relate some of the stories that actually led up to us getting here.
Yeah, sure.
We had our large midsummer event in June. And just a couple of days before we actually went up and kicked off that particular enterprise, we'd been looking around at some properties that we thought might be interesting, something we might want to purchase. And one of them was too steep on a hillside. Another one, no, the only structure that was there was really ugly. And so our fellow who was representing us in this said, you know, this is just not what I'm looking for. And he kind of described the nature of our organization and what we wanted to do. And she said, I have just the place for you. And she took him over and she showed him this building. None of the rest of us had seen it at midsummer. Only he had seen it. And at the midsummer event, we did as we usually do. We consider the entire gathering to be a sort of meta ritual. You know, in the course of that meta ritual, we will do various ceremonial things, various social things, various intellectual things, you know, talks, presentations of various kinds, demonstrations. We will sit at Sumbul and pass the horn and toast. We will give bloat to the gods and so forth. But those are subsets of the larger meta ritual that starts at the very beginning of the event and runs all the way till the last gesture and the last word of the closing ceremony. And this meta ritual always has a particular focus. And at midsummer, that focus was empowerment. Well, we finished midsummer when less than 24 hours, myself and the board of directors were all over looking at this place. And we were blown away. This was exactly the kind of place we needed. It was wooden, it was rectangular, it was large, it had cooking facilities. But you know what really made me know this is the place? Part of the surrounding acreage right around it, you know, there's trees and there's wonderful tables for feasting and so forth. But there were two trees about 8 or 10 feet apart, lovely pines standing straight and tall. In between them was a large rock about 3 or 4 feet high, approximately a cube, and it was oriented north and south. And we knew that was supposed to be our ritual area. So we took a horn of mead and we placed our hands on it and we poured the mead over our hands to connect us to that stone and to each other. And we passed the horn and we made toasts. That was our first ritual on this location. We knew that we wanted this place and we felt that it was our urlog, so to speak, to have it. And that's what kicked it off. And then bam, within hours, we had the whole process underway of acquiring it.
Wow, that's great. So it's actually called New Grange, which is interesting in itself.
Well, It's funny, actually, the way that works. Of course, in America, a Grange Hall has sort of an agricultural connotation. You know, it's the hall that farmers running, I guess, probably back into the last century or even, you know, late 1800s maybe, would go to do farmer things, you know, and where the farmers would meet and the farmers would come together and the farmers would hold their markets and one thing or another. So hence the term Grange. But what we were doing was making it a new Grange. But of course, the play on words there is a location in Ireland, in the Valley of the Boyne. There's an old mound called New Grange, and it has a narrow corridor in one side that runs back into the very center of this mound, where almost all year it is in complete darkness. But on the morning of the winter solstice, it lights up by a beam of sunlight at just the right angle for 17 minutes. That's it. Then the light goes out, and for the rest of the year, it's in darkness. So it's a very special place. It's not specifically Nordic, but I've always been one to look at the connections between the Celtics and the Germanics. And I think that essentially we're, you know, a people divided by language and a few customs. And yeah. So in sort of Northern European unity, so to speak, we thought it would be a nice gesture to call this the New Grange.
I think it's great. Yeah, it's it's believed to be around 3,000, like 200 BC, something like that, making it older than both Stonehenge and the Egyptian pyramids, if you take the, I guess, official, you know, counting on that, whatever. But nonetheless, I mean, it's a very old structure. And of course, it is also religious in nature, I would say, of tracking the seasons and the cycles and the light of the sun, of course. It's very fitting, very fitting.
Well, it is. And another thing about New Grange, if I understand where the scholars are at on it, it seems to have had to do with rebirth, with the idea that the remains of the dead were placed inside the chamber, back at the very back, in little alcoves in the wall there, in the central area. And it's almost as though, and this, what my heart tells me, because sometimes I think it's at least as good as the scholarship, what my instincts tell me is that beam of light piercing the darkness, piercing the womb, so to speak, because it's a very womb-like arrangement when you see it drawn out. It's all about transformation. It's all about birth, rebirth, continuing life, but in a new form. And so it's a very powerful set of symbols and a very powerful influence spiritually. So I feel really good about calling the place New Grange.
Is that how you view the history of Ásatrú, that it's like a thin beam of light that barely was able to come into our time, to light our time, that it made it to us through the time? We might as well be in a position today where no written records or memory of any of this was passed down to us. I mean, it's a real possibility considering what happened in other parts of Europe, where we only have basically a name on a map left behind by the Roman Empire, you know, an entire people, an entire tribe just wiped out, like the Cimbri or the Teutons who emigrated from Jutland, Denmark, and then eventually, you know, managed to threaten the Roman Empire enough for them to destroy them completely. I mean, very little is known by any of these before they were wiped out, and the few remaining that was left were absorbed into the empire as serviles, you know. But Christianity did move in and destroyed who we were. So we barely made it. It's by a thin margin that we can sit here today and actually talk about any of this. Just like that thin light in the passage that you mentioned, it just barely managed to reach us for us to be able to reawaken it again in our times. What a story, huh?
I feel like that. It's as though the light is piercing the soul of our people again and stirring us into wakefulness, into rebirth, like the unvanquished sun.
Yes, absolutely. Very well said. Tell us a bit more about what some of the plans you have for the building then, what you want to do inside and also outside. I mean, are there things you want to do to make it look more like a temple, you know, that we think about when we think of Norse wooden structures and hofs, as they call them, or a longhouse maybe? I mean, there are many beautiful examples to gain inspiration from, even in our times. There's a lot of fun things that could be done here.
Well, we will be making changes. Decorative wise and you know, and landscaping in particular, things of that sort. To give you a little bit better picture of the place, I would ask your listeners to view a rectangular building with a sloping metal roof. It's rectangular, wooden, red, very very bright, kind of a really neat looking place. It's 4,200 square feet. This is not a small building. The great hall area in it, the large open space that takes up the bulk of it, is 40 by 60 feet. So that's 2,400 square feet right there. And we'll use that for many different things, obviously. It has a stage on one side for presenters and for presentations and, you know, one-act play contests, if we want to do that, whatever appeals to us in that regard. It has several rooms that are ideal for offices, and we may, in fact, move some of our administrative functions there and kind of get them out of our house. It has a commercial kitchen on one end, not a little tiny kitchen. It's got a nice big kitchen that's just ideal for serving large crowds. That's the inside. It's big. It's spacious. It's elegant looking. It has that feel of an old-timey building that, even though it's not new and plastic looking and, you know, and all of the things that we get in a building today, it's got an aura of history to it. It's got a feeling of people, of occupation in it. And it's very, very welcoming and very warm in that regard. So if we walk out the back door, we're gonna walk back through the kitchen down there at the far end of it, and then we're gonna walk out the back door. And one of the first things we see is an outdoor area with large, heavy wooden tables. And the tops of these tables are made out of pieces of wood about 3 inches thick. They're sort of like picnic tables, but they're bigger, stronger. They're massive tables, and they're arranged in just the right way for outdoor events, for feasting at night or in the daytime around the fire pit. It's very welcoming and very convivial. It has a that aura of a place that would be really fine to be occupied by people. It needs people in it. And a little bit over to one side is that altar stone that I described earlier with the two trees beside it. Looking around, you see oaks, you see pines, you see cedars, you see waving grass over in a field there. It's alive. It's surrounded by living things. It's a rural potch sort of put into a small town. It's just got a wonderful vibe to it. What we'll be doing is we can start occupying it and using it almost immediately for gatherings and so forth. But obviously we're going to have a lot of work parties up there.
Yeah.
I want to transform portions of it into a garden, maybe a couple of kinds of gardens. I would like a very practical vegetable type garden, but also I want a place that just has flowers, has native plants there. I want to put in a water feature, a little pond perhaps with a bench alongside it, and make it green and cool and comfortable and inviting, a place where people can go and sit and think, just meditate on either their own lives or their what's happening with their situation or deeper philosophical things. A little meditation spot would be great. I want areas where people can conduct small seminars, where they can discuss various issues, have small classes, like, you know, sort of a breakout area, maybe from something that we're doing in the hall. Ultimately, I'd like to make a lot of additions as well. Are you familiar with the kind of god poles that, in particular, a lot of the Slavic pagan groups use?
Oh, yeah. The Perun has I've seen several of those. Beautiful stuff. And Ibn Fadlan, he describes some of that in his Chronicles of the Rus. Remember that? If you read that account, he talks about that they set down these poles and they carved a face at the top of it. And basically, that was a way of seeking not favors maybe, but you know, good relationships with the merchants that they were going to encounter throughout the route and things like this. It's pretty exciting to read about.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and this whole idea of even somewhat rough wooden figurines goes, as you know, way, way, way back in Northern Europe.
Yeah.
All of those finds out of the Danish bogs, you know, you have the carved, roughly anthropomorphic figures. And in modern times, we our own organization has used smaller God poles that stand perhaps 10 feet tall, you know, maybe a foot in diameter, something of that sort. And the stuff that the Slavs are doing right now are really, really nice. They're a little bit better carved than they have to be, really. They're painted, and I think that's very nice. So I think we definitely have to we have to have some stuff like that. It's great for outdoor ritual areas because you don't always want to do rituals inside a building. I mean, why confine the gods to a structure? They blow with the wind. They are the wind. They're beyond the wind. They're behind the wind. All of that. So outside is just fine too. So those are some of the things we've got planned.
Well, that's great. Reading about the Irminsul of the Saxon people, same thing there. A greater, like a mighty pillar. We still don't know if it was just a, sometimes it's described as a tree trunk. Maybe it was part of a tree, either dead or alive, but there's so many wonderful things you can do with the wood like that. I've always wanted to learn how to do that. That's something that I hope a tradition that could be picked up so we could, carve our own totems once again.
Yes, absolutely. I think that there's a lot of ambiguity in the accounts of the Irminsul. You have, of course, depictions from places like in Germany. You know, you've got crude, depictions of what seem to be a tree-like thing with almost a yoke or a crossbar across the top. You have that at Echternsteiner, I believe. And there may be others, I'm not entirely sure. But something of that sort would be very nice. But again, I think there's room for variations and innovation. I'm sure that from one area to another, these would have differed. They wouldn't have been like, all turned out in a Irminsul factory somewhere.
Exactly. Yeah. No, that's true. One thing that's very, very important here, I think, Stephen, is to tie something like this to a location, to a permanent place of having somewhere where people can, return to and start also making it an important place. If we think back on what our ancestors did, I think it's the passage of time and that people again and again return to these sites. That is partially also what made them sacred. I'm not saying that there isn't more to it, and we can talk about that later, about the landscape and these kinds of issues as well. But my point is that think about a tradition that maybe you or I was brought up in, like Christmas or whatever. If we would have grown up without that, we obviously wouldn't have the relationship to it that we do. And I feel that it's important to bring, new young people, children, even teenagers into something like this to start something, to harken back to an older time and starting traditions that is going to be tied to them. And it's not also just making it up out of the blue. These are things that are tied to our people, and our ancient ways already. But how important would you say it is to tie something like this to a permanent place?
I think it's very important. I think that there is an interrelationship, a connection between people and the sacred and the landscape. All these things kind of come together in a point in space and time and beyond space and time. If people come to a particular place for year after year and generation after generation and century after century, I believe that it imbues it with a certain power. It has a bit of their essence in it. It has a bit of their influence in it. And likewise, when people then go there, they experience that. It's like a charge on a battery, I think. Now, I can't prove any of this scientifically. I'm just telling you what I believe, and that's one of the things that I do believe. And, if you've got a young person who starts off there as a baby at their naming rite, 9 days after their birth, and then a few years later, they do their man-taking or woman-taking rituals, and then they get married there. And then someday, finally we'd be doing their funeral service there. This is a continuity. It is part of a life that is not always switching and changing and transforming into something new, modern, and improved, version 6.8 or whatever. It's more than that. It is, in fact, eternal, something that resonates inside the person with who they are, the people that they are a part of, and the landscape that is the scene in Midgard of their actions.
Do you think we're missing something like this in our times? I mean, we're kind of getting into some of the territory now, and that's perfectly fine of what we talked about, what we spoke about last time of your new book, Asa Through a Native European Spirituality, that something like this has been removed from us, and hence we don't have, we lack spiritual traditions, we lack a sense of connectivity with both our ancestors, but also the earth and the larger spiritual life. Is this something we need, do you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We are rootless, but we're not just rootless in one or two aspects, but in many aspects. And this is something I've kind of described before, but I think it's worth a recap. Now, we are connected in certain ways. We're connected with the earth below us. We're connected with the holy powers above us. To either side, we have the men, the women, the children that are a part of our kin group, a part of our folk. Behind us, we have that long, long line of ancestors, many of whose names we'll never even know. And there in front of us, fading off into the other direction, the line of descendants that, well, one hopes, remember our names and to whom we want to be worthy ancestors when that time comes. But modern life cuts us off from this. It's secular. It says that there is nothing other essentially than matter and energy in motion. Basically, you know, dialectical materialism. And it tells us that our ancestors don't matter, that they were fools, or they were savages, or they were, politically incorrect white men, or whatever it may be, and we are to disregard them, and we shouldn't acknowledge that connection. And they're saying that we shouldn't be worrying about descendants because, hey, there's too many people in the world anyway. And so,
right.
People shouldn't be having children. And we just should absorb ourselves in the hedonistic pleasures of the age and forget about any deeper meaning, because ultimately, in the modern worldview, there is no deeper meaning. It's all superficial. That's it. So we are cut off. We are cut off in every dimension, above, below, to either side, before, and in front of us. And we must reestablish those connections. That is what religion is. It comes from a word meaning, implying linkage of connection with things. And it is all about connections. That's what Asa Through is to me, is connections. In space and in time and beyond space and time, with those who gave me life, those to whom I will give life, my living kin, alongside whom I live and laugh and fight.
I mean, it's so important to make these kinds of, I think, positive associations to traditions as well. I mean, it might seem mundane, let's say, to many people, but even the idea of baking gingerbread cookies during Christmas or something. I mean, think about the positive association that has with a child when they grow up and they become anchored in those traditions. And some we have, of course, are more, recent, and some, the whole Yule celebration is very ancient, of course, of bringing in the tree. I think it even harkened back to the Norse tradition of hanging, the red, Christmas balls that you hang in your tree. I mean, who knows, maybe that goes back to the blute of, bloody pieces that hangs in the green tree, so all these things are connected. But my point is that it's so important to make these positive traditions and start. We have to begin somewhere. That is my point. That even if it seems contrived to some today, think about what this place also might mean in 200-300 years from now, Stephen. If we think ahead of time, and if generations after generations have been coming to some of these places, they are going to be charged with the thing that you described. This is going to be anchored in their soul to a certain degree. It's we have to think forward and long term here.
I completely agree. I only wish that we had more acreage because, I might decide to be buried there or something.
Right,
And I would hope that 10 generations from now, my descendants would come and pour a horn of mead onto my mound and give me might and main on the far side, that I may in turn give back to them, love and protection.
Yeah.
And to do that, you have to have tradition. You can't live in a world that is based on superficialities. You can't live in a world that's based on, the latest movie or the latest style or just reading people's Twitter feed. I'm always amazed whenever I open up my mail and in my Yahoo account, there'll be all of these solicitations. If you hit here and see what some person whose name I don't even recognize, see what they're tweeting. Why should I care? Why should I care? I've got a life. I don't need their life. I don't know them. They're not my kin. They're not my friends. I probably wouldn't even like them. And I certainly don't like the fact that I'm having to put up with this solicitation when I'm trying to find out what Henrik is sending me.
Yeah, it's a cult of celebrity, and we've replaced that. I mean, many people listening know this, of course, but it's important to reiterate that it's completely controlled and contrived, and we've lost all kind of meaning in the things that we spend time on, and it's just such a waste, and it really is the pinnacle of modernity, of how we live today and how ruthless we have become. And it's very sad to see that, and whatever we can do to return back to something that encapsulate meaning and purpose. And it's not about everyone maybe agreeing with that, but the idea that there's a concerted effort to try to do something to counteract the environment that we find ourselves in right now.
Yes, I don't need celebrities. I don't even need role models. What I need, and what I think many people need, I think what our people need, probably what all peoples everywhere on the world need, is heroes. We need models of great accomplishment. And if you've got tradition, and if you've got a place like our Hof, where you can go to steep yourself in that tradition and to walk on the ground where people before you have walked, and remembering back the stories that you were told, at your mother's knee. If you can make those connections, you've got possibly heroes, but at least people to emulate. You've got people to whom you're connected. You've got stories that relate to your life and the lives of every person who is closest to you on that inner concentric circle that we all build around us. So, and that is geographical, it's spatial. You need a place where you can experience this, a place where you can allow yourself to be imprinted with this higher vibration and apply that to your lives and to your actions.
What do you think can come of this in the larger picture here? Do you think that this is something that could spread and give ideas to other people to do something similar themselves, that seek to spread our old, well, it's really about reawakening our old faith, our old ways of telling that the time is ready. We've had a 1,000 years of darkness, and as we said before, it's time for that light to return again.
Well, yes, I think that this is a sign of things to come. Already there have been stirrings. An outfit in England, the Odinist Fellowship, in I think the last year or so, purchased an old medieval chapel and converted it to Odinic worship. And I thought that was very neat. That was a very good beginning. Other people have built, as I say, smaller structures, usually on private land. And there's a guy named Will back east. And if Will listens to this, he'll know it's him I'm talking about. And he has been building hofs on people's lands, and there's many others. It's not entirely without precedent. It's been kind of sputtering along. We've been seeing the smoke before the flame actually breaks, and the Icelanders are still going through their governmental procedures, and so it'll be mired down in modern state bureaucracy for a while, and ultimately they'll have theirs. But in the meantime, we'll be doing it. We'll have ours. We will be using it for all sorts of purposes, and those purposes will, I hope, inspire others to do exactly the same thing.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we need, and hopefully we have in the works several in Scandinavia as well. I mean, Uppsala is I personally believe not where the people tell us that it was right now. It's a long story and too much to go into, right now. But point is, I think we'll need something in the heart of the land of Scandinavia as well, and where at least we thought that the old one was burnt as a kind of a, I don't know, it's a very symbolic act as well, I feel, of reawakening that energy of saying that, you know, if this is the place where the last one was burnt, then here's the one that we shall build up again to show that we're back and we're here to stay, you know?
Yes. Yes, I love it. Yes, I absolutely support that idea. Let a thousand hoofs spring forth.
Yes. Exactly. I agree. Very good. Now let's talk a little bit about, we have much more to discuss here, but let's talk more about the actual, project, if you will, how people can, you know, get involved. You guys have set up an Indiegogo page, as you said. We're going to have the link up to that. We can also tell people how just to search for it and find it on Indiegogo.com. But there's money has been raised already, of course. I think as the time of this recording, it's up towards 18% already, which is great. Tell us how people can help support you guys in this.
Well, obviously, to be blunt, people can send us money.
That's it. And,
you know, that would help. That's kind of how we're going to pay for all of this, and they can do that through the Indiegogo site. And we appreciate a large contribution or a small contribution. Some people can give much, some cannot, but we do appreciate each and every bit that we get. And in addition to that, we would hope that your listeners will tell other people they know, build the network, make it go viral, get the word out there so that there are other people. And yeah, we will find people who will come and rally to us and who will help this happen. And once it happens with us, it'll happen more easily with everyone else. There goes your 100th monkey effect.
Yep.
You know, it's not just about us. And people might say, why should I in Dubuque, Iowa, or in Stockholm, why should I contribute to something that's happening in Northern California? Northern California is full of weirdness anyway. But actually, Northern California is pretty sane and sober compared to the rest of the state and many other places. And what we're doing here will pave the way. For example, just talking about within the AFA here, so what do we get out of this? You know, if I live in the Midwest, why should I support the AFA HOF in Northern California? Well, one reason is that if we pull this off financially, we then have a really nice credit rating. We can undertake to build other ones across the country. So it's a matter of getting established and in a way of sort of cranking out HOFs in various regions as people need them. We can show that this works, and we can inspire people, and we can show people how to do it in many ways. You know, learn from our mistakes and help us to do it right to start with. So everyone's got something involved in this. Everyone who cares about the fate of our people, everyone who cares about our traditions, everyone who cares about our faith and its spiritual applications and that spiritual undergirding that supports everything we do in the world, all have an interest in this.
Exactly. I agree. I mean, I'm going to help and chip in on this as well. I mean, I hope, of course, I get to visit one day. But the point is, even if I don't, I consider it to be important to have something like this achieved, to have it built as a symbol, both for our people and for our traditions, of a mark to others, even if it is to get that message out that it's possible and it's something that's starting to happen, and the people around know that there is something like this on the rise. Because I think, Stephen, as we've spoken about many times before, I think that there is an attraction to these things for obvious reasons. Of feeling this void and emptiness of sorts, and you know, great things do have small beginnings, and we have to begin somewhere. And I think this is the step to take. So I hope it goes down, you know, real well for you guys. And we have, let's just talk about how many days we have left here as well, because there's a little bit of a time limit on this currently. And when we do this recording, it's about 37 days left. So obviously, we want to try to achieve that before this time. But tell us what happens when you achieve what you need.
If we get the full amount before the closure time, then people can continue to donate into that. So, you know, that can continue. And if this campaign isn't enough, then we might choose some small goal in addition to, say that off of this campaign, let's say that we get what we need to get started, to get the place, to get it in good enough shape that we can actually start using it. Then if, say, we wanted to erect an Irminsul, we could do a separate campaign and say, hey, everybody, here's what we're doing, and we'd appreciate your help. And of course, that price would be much, much smaller than what we're asking now. It would just be kind of, you know, topping things off a bit. So there are ways of raising that money, and it's this crowdsourcing stuff is very, very interesting.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you guys are going to get this done. I mean, I want everyone who listens, who's passionate about this, to help out. You know, ladies and gentlemen, it's very important. It's a symbolic act, I feel, and I want everyone who knows what's at stake here and who understands the dynamics of the times that we find ourselves in to, you know, let's get this done, okay? You know, let's make sure that we can achieve something like this. I mean, even it's as they always say, but even if we have 40,000 people donating, $1.50 each, it's done. You know what I mean? So it's just about getting the numbers and getting to that point and showing that if we can do it here, we can do it in other places, and it can, you know, build a snowball effect and start heading in the right direction. So, you know, I'm all supportive of this, and I think it's going to go down very well, because it's just so important, Stephen, you know?
Well, obviously I agree. And, you know, there's another larger issue that's also at stake here. Those of us who practice the old faith, whether we call it Asatru or Odinism or, you know, any of a variety of things in our different countries, there's quite a few of us now. We're not just a couple of thousand people scattered around the globe. We're hundreds of thousands of people scattered around the globe. And we forget that we are able to exercise our power together. And often we talk a lot, but when it comes down to putting in money or time or whatever it may be, you know, putting in actual effort into our faith, we're not always on top of it. And people sit back and they'll post all day, and they'll post these hellacious Viking memes on Facebook or whatever.
You know, yeah, exactly.
How tough Vikings they are or whatever. But not only do they not go to the gym, but, you know, they don't support the larger movement. We've got to have people understand that if this is going to go anywhere, if we're going to do our duty to the gods, to serve our folk and to make the world a better place, we're going to have to all pull together. And that means we need to flex those muscles. We need to flex those muscles socially, politically, financially, whatever it may be, in order to work together and realize we do have power. We are not just victims. We don't have to quietly take it anymore. We don't have to allow the world around us, the society around us, the philosophies around us to destroy us as individuals or collectively, or to destroy our people and our philosophies. We don't have to put up with it. We can exert our power. And a project like this one, or many other noble ones, is an ideal way for people to get that. Oh, my goodness, look what we did. We raised, you know, X amount of money. We built this. We built that. And once people realize that, it binds them together in a special way. And they're not powerless anymore. And they don't have to just, you know, sit in the basement and type away on the keyboard or something. They've got real lives, and they've got purpose, and they've got might and main and will. And at that point, we can do anything.
Absolutely. To serve our folks, that's what it's about here. I mean, we had... Well, Matthew Tate mentioned something interesting about the Mormons, for example, and they've been, if you go back in their past, they've been horribly suppressed by the state. Even they had to flee and pick up, and I think that's how they ended up in Utah, for one. But nonetheless, the point here is that they donate a lot of their money to the church, and they have done, of course, tremendous things. And I'm not talking about whether you agree with their religion or choices of life or not. I'm talking about just as a mechanism of what the people can be able to do. Look at some of the businesses they have, you know, started up, and they support each other. And this is kind of an idea of what to look here, because people do horribly destructive things with their hard-earned money. But just as you say, Stephen, as soon as it comes to you know, helping each other out and things like that. People fall away, and it's horrible to see that. And so let's not do that here, you know, because I mean, we have, for example, mosques going up in Sweden paid by the taxpayer, and yet we can't build a temple that's dedicated to our own people. Even the idea that this already haven't been done is just, it's just saddening, folks. And I mean, we have to start turning things around on this note, and we have to start in one direction. So, you know, I don't know what more to say there. I mean, we have to start helping each other out and put our supportive efforts behind, you know, the things that we claim that we are for. So yeah, absolutely, Stephen. Anything to add to that?
No, I just agree. I completely agree. Absolutely. We've got to exercise our will and put some work into things. Once we do that, we'll find we really like it, that we are really building community, that we really are building a folk in something other than just the biological sense, that we are, in fact, exercising those bonds that tie us together. And that's a very potent feeling and a very good feeling and a very natural feeling and beneficial all around.
That's right. Okay, let's talk about some of the websites here. Then obviously, let me see if I can search. Yeah, I mean, folks, you can just go to, if you're not on our website right now, you can just go to indiegogo.com and basically type in either Newgrange Hall or Åsat through Hof, and you'll get the hit on the page that we're talking about here, where you can go to look at the video, of course, but also read a bit more about how you can help out and how you donate money, basically. But we'll have the link up as well. But one other thing we should talk about as well, Stephen, by the way, that we didn't already, is that the new website design is up. The new site looks great, by the way. It's a great update, and it's just like we're seeking to do here soon. It's brought up into the new times of web design, basically.
Well, yes, we're kind of proud of that. We think that's really good, and the actual Åsat through Folk Assembly one, you know, is AsatruFolkAssembly.org now, but if anyone just goes to runestone.org, they will get access both to the Åsat through Folk Assembly site and our store as well, Runestone store. So that's probably just as good as entry as any, as the old runestone.org URL.
You bet. Also check out the book, of course, folks, that we spoke about last time, Åsat through a Native European Spirituality, to kind of, well, get the backdrop really on some of the things that we're talking about here, and also the reasons why a hof, a temple, call it what you will, is an important step. And you can, of course, go back and check out the previous shows we've done as well. But is there anything else you want to say before we wrap up for the first segment here about the either the project or the hof, or anything more to motivate people to help out?
Tell others, make it go viral. And while you're at it, please read my book. I think it's a very important book, and it really presents what I believe constitutes a new paradigm, a new way forward for the European descended peoples, how we can return to our roots, recover our lost ancestral soul that's wandering around out there in the netherworld somewhere, and fulfill our destiny.
Right, very good. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a short break here in a little bit, and then we're going to talk more in the second hour of the website again. Is of course runestone.org, and that will take you to the new design, the new website, which is authorthroughfolkassembly.org. So we'll have both of these links up there as well. But all right, stay with us, folks. Stay with us, Stephen. We'll take a short break, and then we'll be right back with more. Ladies and gentlemen, in the second hour, as we pick up and speak more, not only about the necessity to take a next step of action to start building something that will lead to something new anchored in something old, we also speak about how Christianity took over European societies and especially the northern lands, and how they built their invasive structures next to or on top of our burnt sacred temples and other ritual sites. We speak about how they enchanted the land with song and prayer. We relate this to what is happening today when a third wave of Abrahamism is sweeping over Europe. This time, it has been imported by our so-called leadership into Europe. Now they're starting to sing their songs from the minarets, the Middle Eastern songs, now enchanting the land for them. And the question is, how do we stop this? How do we counteract this and bring out our own enchantments? We do speak more about how to return to the ways of our forebears and implement magical warfare and making the land come alive for us once again. We also spend some time talking about some of the upcoming events and some of Stephen's anti-poaching work. A very important second hour is coming up. Please join us at redicemembers.com. Go there to sign up for a membership and tune in. Get instant access and start streaming or downloading all of our previous shows. We have some other great guests lined up as well. Eric Hunt, Angelo John Gage, Karen Smith, Daryl Hamamoto, and Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. But we'll pick this up on the other side of the break. Thank you for listening, and please do stay with us.